The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Much like a sophisticated bank heist, there is something undeniably fascinating about art frauds and forgeries, perhaps because we are bombarded with stories of incompetent or abjectly violent crimes. The skill and planning and access required to successfully dupe the art world easily captivates the public imagination. Today on the show, we'll go behind the scenes of the museum world with a look at some new technology being used by conservators and curators to preserve and even duplicate priceless works of art. We'll also hear about some old-fashioned detective work that one historian employs to find the origins of an artifact. We'll start with the case of a prolific forger who successfully duped collectors and historians alike until he was caught. Anthony Amore is chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston and author of The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. Amore explains the rise and fall of a great many master forgers, from the cunning to the delusional, including Wolfgang Beltracchi, who Amore says may be the very best of them all.
Wow, the Beltracchi case is one that the people who've heard about it or read about it are just taken with. First of all, even though he wasn't known to the people who bought the paintings, he was doing the forgeries behind the scenes. Once he was exposed as the artist of the true artist of these Kempendonk paintings and Max Ernst, etc., he is such an engaging character. He looks like what you would envision an art forger to look like. He has this impish way about him. He speaks with this German accent, but in a way that's sort of endearing. And I think he captures the imagination of people who like to romanticize the idea of these art criminals.
What was his technique?
It's really a fascinating story. You know, my entire book, just to backtrack for a second, is about really the people who buy these paintings, who acquire these forgeries. I think my hypothesis is that they are more victims of the elaborate story behind the paintings than the art itself. So Wolfgang Beltracchi had this scam that he pulled with his wife, Helene, and they created provenance for paintings he painted in the style of certain abstract expressionists. So for instance, he would imagine a painting by Max Ernst, and he would execute it, and he would do a reasonably good job. I wouldn't know it from the real Max Ernst sorts of works. But the real trick to selling these was his ability to create provenance for these paintings. So when his wife would bring them to art dealers and say, "I have this Max Ernst painting," and the dealer would say, "Where did you get it?" She had this incredibly elaborate story about her father, and said that these paintings belonged to her father, who hid them from the Nazis, and she inherited them from him after his death, and she was producing this new collection to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this provenance that tricked the dealers and a believing public.
They even took photographs and sort of artificially aged them so it would look like her grandmother sitting in the salon with all of these pictures in the background.
Unbelievable. I mean, Wolfgang went out and bought a period camera from her grandmother's time and the period paper and took pictures of his wife dressed as her own grandmother in front of these forgeries and used that as provenance.
We've introduced so many things. First of all, provenance is the art world term for origins, I guess, and the history of how it changed hands from person to person. Have I got that right?
You do. And what makes it difficult in the art world is that there's no set form for provenance. It's not like a birth certificate. Well, it's issued by the state, and this is what it should look like, et cetera. There's provenance can come in many different forms, including a photo of your family member from the time.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing about Beltracchi that I think is so daring and interesting is that he wasn't just copying known existing works. He was, as you say, kind of imagining, he was creating new work as if by these artists.
Exactly correct. He would imagine a Campendonk painting and imagine what he would have created and he went and made them. And again, to the layman or even to the novice collector, they're easily passable. But what you find with Beltracchi is that even the experienced collectors and dealers were buying into the story based on the strength of this provenance. Beltracchi even went as far as to create fake labels, aged labels, to put in the back of paintings, showing that they came from a Nazi-era art dealer in Germany. So the dealers didn't have to suspend disbelief. He provided all of the provenance for them, but maybe in many cases, lazy legwork led to the sale of millions of dollars worth of these paintings.
How much did his forgery sell for?
They would sell for typically in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, but in the high numbers. I mean, Steve Martin, the actor, paid, I believe it was $600,000 for one of these paintings and later had to sell it at a great loss.
How were his works finally detected as frauds?
Well, eventually, one of his paintings was examined by a gentleman named Dr. Nicholas Eastaw in London, and he has a company called Art Access and Research. And Nick Eastaw is an amazing, he's not just a scientist who can use these elaborate tools that I can't even pronounce to examine the science behind art, but he's also a conservator, so he can look at art from an art history and technique perspective. And when he examined these paintings, and I interviewed him, and he told me that technically these were not great forgeries. They were easy to detect. But one of the things he found was in a certain Campendonk painting, a paint was used called titanium white.
Mm-hmm.
And that was shown through the chemical analysis. And Dr. Eastaw was able to show that titanium white did not exist in the time of Campendonk. That was not a color that would have been available to the actual artist, so he showed it would have to have been made after the fact. But you can see it was just this one pigment. Other than that, how would the buyer know? Well, that's titanium white. That's not the correct white from the period. So it took scientific analysis, and what I believe Dr. Eastaw was able to show, and he claims, and I agree, is that many of these forgeries are not difficult to discern using science and using the expertise that he has.
I'm speaking with Anthony Amore. He's chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston and author of The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. And we're talking about one of the forgers he writes about in his book, Wolfgang Beltracchi, who did more than simply copy famous works. He actually created new paintings in the style of well-known modernists and made millions before eventually being caught. I want to talk about the science in just a moment, but first, just to get a larger sense of Wolfgang Beltracchi, he was interviewed for a British news program last year. Here's a clip. Now, he's talking about the painting that got him caught. Now, this is a forgery in the style of the modernist painter, Henrik Campendonk, titled Red Picture with Horses.
That was the most expensive Campendonk ever sold, nearly 3 million euros.
Except it wasn't a Campendonk.
Yeah, it was not a Campendonk. It was for me, sure. Hmm. Oh, it was the best one.
Do you mean the best one of
the
yours?
The best Campendonk.
Is that what you think? You think that your Campendonk was the best Campendonk?
Yeah, that's a little bit difficult. But it was sold as the best Campendonk was ever sold.
Yeah, but was it the best Campendonk?
Yeah, sure.
So fascinating. What does that little clip tell us about the psychology of Beltracchi and maybe even larger of forgers in general? I mean, you got to be pretty confident to be a con artist.
You do. And there's no question these guys are talented. I mean, he's a talented artist. I remember reading how he had said if the artist that he was channeling was left-handed, he would paint with his left hand.
Wow.
And, you know, I wonder if that's true, but I wouldn't put it past him. You can see from that clip, he is sort of an endearing guy. He's hard not to like.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't seem as much as ego as he almost seems wide-eyed when he says that. But what it tells us is that people affix dollar values to art, and once you have a number attached to it, you associate it with greatness, when that might not be the case. You know, the whole idea of art, the beauty being in the eye of the beholder, kind of gets lost in this. Even in when I walk around a museum with people and give them a tour here or there, when I point out a great painting, they'll say to me, "How much is it worth?" As if saying that it's $50 million instead of $500,000 makes it a nicer painting.
Hmm.
And I think that's a commentary, and you could make an argument for that, actually. But there's no question, especially in 2015, that people associate dollar figures with greatness.
Beltracchi was sentenced to 6 years in prison in 2011. But, you know, similar to what you were talking about earlier, the idea that the art world assigns value to things, he got a little bit of a public following there. What do you think of the public regard for, or sort of cheering on in some way, of con men and forgers? What does that say about how the art world is perceived? Like, we're cheering on the guy who hoodwinked them.
It's an excellent point. You know, when the entire book, The Art of the Con, deals mainly with modern paintings, abstract expressionists, etc. And I think for the common person out there, they look at some of these paintings and they say, you know, I could do that, or my kid could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see, well, that painting went for $115 million, and it just boggles the mind. So I think, for the layperson, when they hear that someone like Wolfgang Beltracchi was able to rip off the guy who spent $1 million on one of his forgeries, there's sort of a Robin Hood sort of attitude, like, oh, well, you know, he took money from a willing dupe.
Yeah.
Who was buying something silly anyway. So it doesn't seem like as much of a crime. It obviously there's a victim, but it seems maybe to some that it's victimless because what the money was going to be spent on was silly anyway.
Hmm. How does the art world view his forgeries? You know, are they still in circulation?
You know, he's still working with authorities to identify some of his other paintings that are in circulation. After he was convicted, a list of, I want to say, 15 more were released.
Hmm.
And it's believed that there is still, you know, more than a dozen out there. So we may never know. And I think it might be subject to the whims of Wolfgang Beltracchi as to whether he tells.
Well, in your book, you put a lot of faith in the ways that science can expose fraud and forgeries now, the kind, you know, just analyzing the paint, for example, that you mentioned earlier. Do you think it's maybe dangerous to be overconfident about the ability of science to discern and beat the bad guys?
I don't know if it's dangerous. I think the problem is more with people who don't bother to use the services that these analysts can provide. We have one in New England named Jamie Martin, who is an extraordinarily talented person as well in identifying these frauds. Now, I mean, the greater question is it an exact science? And no, but I think it's as near as you can get. And I would say this, if I was going to spend $100 million on a painting, I would certainly spend the thousands of dollars it would take to have, say, Dr. Eastor or his associate, Jalene Nadalny. I would pay them to look at it before I made that sort of investment.
Well, you're chief investigator for a museum. You have a lot more access and probably money to do that kind of forensic work, more so than an individual dealer or a curator or a gallerist, don't you?
I think when we're talking about someone that's going to, in the book, we're talking about individuals, investors. And I do think that if you're going to invest that much money into something, I think it makes sense to test its bona fides. And again, relative cost is extremely low.
Well, given your work at the Gardner Museum, where this notorious heist took place in 1990, and looking at the kind of way that forensics experts can look at forgeries, could either of those things happen in the art world again, a heist on that scale, or a forgery on the scale of Beltracchi and others that you write about in the book?
I'm sad to say they could. I mean, I'm happy to say that it wouldn't happen at the Gardner again. But I can tell you that art theft happens every day. And just a couple of years ago, there was a massive theft at the Kunsthalle Museum. And if if your listeners Google art theft every week, they're going to see more heist. It's a $6 to $8 billion per year illicit industry, stolen art. In terms of forgeries, the way I end my book with an epilogue of, as I was finishing the book, these were the stories that were in the news just in the last couple of days. And there were more forgeries, more fakes, more scams. And it's something that will never go away, but we can be more vigilant.
How much time do you spend thinking about that heist and especially the fate of those paintings?
Virginia, it's all of my waking moments and most of my sleeping.
Really?
and I can speak for my colleagues in the FBI, it's a complete, absolute, undying obsession with recovering these paintings, which we will one day.
Anthony Amore, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Anthony Amore, he's chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, also author of Stealing Rembrandts and more recently, The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. And you can read more about his work and find a link to hear that full interview with Wolfgang Beltracchi. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
A part of our heritage has been stolen from us. It's a barbaric act.
The act was larceny on a grand scale. Two thieves dressed as Boston policemen broke into the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum early Sunday morning. They stole 11 paintings and etchings in an ancient Chinese vase. Museum officials today said it was the largest art heist in history.
Obviously, these are priceless works, and they cannot be sold. So a dollar value is irrelevant.
That was some archival footage from a press conference held in the days following that famous art heist in Boston that Anthony is still losing sleep over. Rick Abbott was the unlucky guard on duty that fateful night back in March of 1990, who was tricked into opening the door to the Gardner Museum. 25 years after the robbery, he sat down for StoryCorps and talked about it with his wife, Diana.
At the time of the robbery, I had just dropped out of Berklee College of Music. I was playing in a jam band and working night shift at the museum. I was just this hippie guy who wasn't hurting anything, wasn't on anybody's radar. And the next day, I was on everybody's radar for the largest art heist in history. You know, most of the guards were either older or they were college students. Nobody there was capable of dealing with actual criminals. But that night, two cops rang the doorbell. They had hats, badges, they looked like cops, and I let them in. They said, "Are you here alone?" And I said, "I have a partner that's out on a round." They said, "Call him down." And they said, "Gentlemen, this is a robbery." They duct taped around our eyes and duct taped like the bottom of my chin to the top of my head. And they handcuffed me to the electrical box for 7 hours. At first, I was panicking. And then I started singing "I Shall Be Released" by Bob Dylan. I don't know how long I was singing that damn song for, but it was quite some time. They took three Rembrandts, a Vermeer, a Manet, a bunch of sketches by Degas, and two of the Rembrandts. They cut them out of the frames. So even if they get the paintings back, they'll never be the same. And I feel horrible about that.
You ever feel embarrassed about it?
More than anything else, I'm angry about it. I don't want to be remembered for this alone. I'd like to be remembered for the good things I've done. I'm a husband. I'm a father of two really cool kids. But they're saying it's $500 million worth of artwork. And ultimately, I'm the one who made that decision to buzz them in. It's the kind of thing most people don't have to learn to cope with. It's like doing penance. It's always there.
They say every man must need protection. They say every male must fall. Yet I swear I see my reflection.
That's Rick Abbath with his wife Diana at StoryCorps in Vermont. Their conversation will be archived along with all StoryCorps interviews at the Library of Congress.
I see my light come shining.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to guiding patrons and tour groups, most museums supplement their professional staff with volunteer docents. The number of arts-loving baby boomers now volunteering at museums is expected to grow more than 20% in the next 5 years. Sounds like a win-win, right? Well, sometimes the free help is not so helpful. The guides go rogue, improvising tours, ignoring rules, touching priceless works, and relaying incorrect information. Ellen Gammerman wrote about docents gone wild for the Wall Street Journal. And Ellen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So are most museum docents in this boomer demographic?
Many of them are, for the simple reason that they have the time, if they're in the boomer demographic that has actually retired. But museums are trying to sort of rebrand themselves in many cases, attract a younger crowd, a more diverse crowd. And part of that means trying to bring in more younger tour guides and change their programs. But the baby boomers are well represented in this group, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the more memorable stories you've heard of unhinged docents?
Okay, well, I should preface all of it by saying to all the docents out there that for every story that I have about docents becoming unhinged, there are many examples of very dedicated, professional people doing this free work for museums that rely on them for this essential service. But having said that, I was at a conference of museum professionals in April, and one of the panels was called Waking Up from Volunteer Nightmares. And there in this conference room at 8:30 in the morning, it was packed. There were stories of bickering spouses, problems with touching the art, as you mentioned.
You actually also heard some stories of people giving false information about the artwork?
Well, yeah, and this is something that if you talk to enough volunteer supervisors, they will tell you happens all the time. The U.S. Midway Museum in San Diego, which has a very robust volunteer corps, they send out what they call the bum dope report every so often, and it just lists the bloopers that they've heard around the ship from different docents, and then you find out what was said, you find out what you should say. I have heard from a lot of museum goers who have said when they've approached their docent and after a tour and gently said, you know, actually that thing you said is wrong, they haven't always felt so comfortable kind of confronting the docent who feels pretty confident in their study and in their information. There was this one case I spoke with, a tourist. She had visited the old exchange and provost dungeon in Charleston, South Carolina, and her colonial docent went off script, started improvising, and said, well, I'm going to tell you this, and I just made it up, but it could be true. And she looked at her friends and just couldn't believe what she'd heard and thought, I just paid for that?
So docents just kind of overstepping their bounds, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, one volunteer manager I spoke with at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, you know, she said that there's this culture of resistance, and they've been really trying to change their program, and she felt that some of the volunteers had felt that after spending enough time there, they felt entitled, and they didn't want to make changes from the way they had previously done things. So when the Hirshhorn changed its program, tried to bring in more college-age students, and some of the volunteers who had been giving tours at the Hirshhorn for longer than their managers probably had been alive, you mm-hmm. know, in some of these cases decades, you know, they felt very disrespected and insulted.
Yeah.
And forced out.
Well, what does it take to become a tour guide or a volunteer docent? Is it a competitive thing at museums?
It can be. At some of the big city museums, it can be quite a status symbol and quite competitive. You can apply and not even get into the training. You know, at the Whitney Museum in New York, they get more than 100 applications for what ends up being about 30 slots in the training. And over the course of months and months and months of training, 10 people may drop out. So the graduating class is about 20 people who have studied and learned about gesturing and eye contact. It's not just sort of the art history side of it, but they're also learning about body language and how to engage a crowd. So a lot of people take it quite seriously, and a lot of museums take it very seriously.
Okay, so are there any real success stories when it comes to that docent-museum relationship?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all over. And like I said, they are kind of a lifeblood of many of these museums that need the staff and can't afford them. I spoke with people at military museums where a lot of the volunteers are veterans, and some of the people who are giving the tours have incredible backstories, you know, the experiences that they've had as combat veterans or prisoners of war or what have you. So there's a lot that these docents and tour guides and volunteers may find they have in common with each other, and those experiences can really enrich a tour if you're on a warship and the person you're talking to was a prisoner of war, let's say, in Vietnam, which is the case on the Midway Museum. You know, you can have quite a conversation there.
Mm. I wonder if it was tough for you, Ellen, to get museum personnel to go on record about docents. It could disturb that relationship quite a bit if they were heard to be complaining about their docents.
Yeah, because you just can't. I mean, in a lot of cases, a volunteer might be the wife of a huge contributor, or just, you know, just a very nice person who has worked there for years, you just whatever. You don't want to insult the people who are working right next to you. But at the same time, you know, there's mounting frustration. One museum staffer described it on the record as mutiny on the Bounty. You know, and you know, they're trying to rein in people who don't necessarily feel like being told what to do.
Well, Ellen, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Gammerman, she covers arts and entertainment for the Wall Street Journal. That's where we found her article, Docents Gone Wild. And you can find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. If you're lucky, you've been to a natural history museum and stared in wonder at fossils that are millions of years old. Part of the amazement we feel at seeing artifacts of our earliest ancestors or dinosaurs or other creatures that predate humans is knowing that they're the real deal. But is authenticity really essential to their educational or scientific value? Advanced 3D printing technology is giving museum curators the option of keeping their most rare and fragile artifacts safely tucked away while still putting science and history on view to museum visitors. Here to talk with us about her work with 3D printers is Carolyn Thome. She's a digital model maker at the Smithsonian Institution. And we read about the Smithsonian's efforts to craft perfect replicas in the Atlantic magazine. Carolyn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what is the Smithsonian using 3D printing for?
Just as you said, we are replicating some artifacts that are either too fragile to be on display or they're not in our possession, mostly obviously artifacts that we can get digital data from. And sometimes we actually are not even duplicating artifacts. We make models. And that's my main job, is to create models for exhibits.
So I did read about replicating an extremely rare skull. This is something that you do? You make models of rare skulls?
Yes.
How do you actually do this?
At the Natural History Museum, we have a medical CT scanner in the anthropology department. So a lot of the fossils and even some modern bones are scanned there. And so the digital data is collected for researchers to look over these artifacts or to share them with other institutions. So we get that scan data and clean it up digitally, because sometimes it has some digital noise to it. And then we will send it to the 3D printer and print it for whatever use. Usually it goes on display at the museum, or it's to share with other researchers around the world.
So how about choosing an example of something you have replicated, brought through the whole process?
I have Homo floresiensis, which is otherwise known as the Hobbit, something that we have duplicated about 10 or so times. It is a fossil that was found in Indonesia on the island of Flores in a cave, and the fossil is still in Indonesia, but there is a researcher, Dr. Matt Tocheri, who was able to CT scan and laser scan all the bones from this one individual. And he has the digital data for that, and he works with the Indonesians in providing copies to other institutions. So we 3D print the bones that they could find, and then when they come out of our printer, we hand paint them to look like the original.
So could a museum viewer pick out which fossils have been printed? I mean, are they really good replicas of the originals?
They are really good replicas, but what we do at the Smithsonian is if something is on display and it is not the actual artifact, it is part of the label. It's always identified.
What's the advantage of 3D printing for this kind of work rather than making molds otherwise?
There's a couple things. You can make a digital copy of something, which means you're not handling it as much as you would if you were making a mold. So if you're making a mold of something, you're putting rubber on it and you're handling it a lot and you're exposing it to chemicals. If you're making a digital copy, you're laser scanning it or CT scanning it or using photogrammetry to create the object. So you have very little interaction with the object and definitely no chemical interaction with the actual object. And also for 3D printing, the thing I like to go by is if it can't be manufactured in another way, then 3D printing is the way to go. Mm-hmm. So say for skulls that are CT scans, so if they're CT scan, they have the interior information and the exterior information, and then you can print all of that. You couldn't have made the interior information from doing a cast.
What are some of the other artifacts that you're replicating, or is it all the bones and fossils?
A lot of it is bones and fossils. Quality of the print really lends itself to bones. But another group that we're working with is the Repatriation Office. A lot of artifacts are going back to the tribes that claim them, and we ask permission to make copies for our own research collection.
It adds so much to the museum experience to see something, the original Mona Lisa, you know, that's just an example.
Right.
And the museum would never say this is a print of a painting and say it's equal to the originals. So what is the difference, do you think, between looking at a copy of an artifact, you know, that Hobbit skull, for example, and seeing a really good print of a famous picture?
The Hobbit skull you would never be able to see. You would have to go to Indonesia. So we're providing a way for the visitor to get the same feeling as looking at the real skeleton, and also putting it out there that it is a copy. So for the Mona Lisa, you know where it is. You have to go to it to go see it.
Right.
If you want to go to the Indonesia to go see the Hobbit, you can do that too.
Does that do anything to your sense of wonder when looking at an object? You know, if you were seeing a display that said something was a replica, would it feel the same?
First of all, I see it from a model maker's point of view as like, oh, wow, that's a really nice job. You know, they did a great job on that. But I think I've just been educated enough to understand that the real thing can't be on display. I think as long as I know ahead of time that there might be some copies out there, that's fine.
Is there any concern about that at all, that you're kind of, I don't know, opening the tube of toothpaste of making great forgeries as someone who's in the museum business?
I don't even go there to think about that. I'm a good federal employee who is just doing her job to make models for exhibits. In my mind, it's not really a worry, but I'm sure there's people out there working on these.
Well, Carolyn, thank you for speaking with us.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Carolyn Thome, she's an exhibit specialist, digital model maker for the Smithsonian Institution. And you can find links to read more about her work, creating 3D models of hominid skulls for a traveling exhibition. It's called Exploring Human Origins. That's at our website. There's also a link there to read about the fine art of forgery being done by museums from The Atlantic magazine, both at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about how the Smithsonian is using 3D printing and other digital technology to build its exhibitions. Now to an historical museum show in New Hampshire that required some old-school detective work.
Well, my name is Astrida Schaefer, and I'm a costume historian, independent scholar. I have my own business in which I make mannequins for museums to show their historic textiles on.
Okay, so there's a job you may not have known existed. Recently, Astrida curated an exhibit called Embellishments, Constructing Victorian Detail, which is on view at the Portsmouth Athenaeum until November the 6th. The show features a number of striking dresses from the late 19th century, each with its own fascinating backstory.
For me, it is very much being a sleuth. I get presented with an object like this dress, and at times very little information, and I have to examine it and pick up clues and put together pieces and connect the dots to create, recreate, to find the woman inside the dress.
So Astrida Schaefer is something of a dress detective. And when we spoke to her, she told us the story of cracking one of the toughest cases in the exhibit.
The dress is this lovely ribbed silk, so it has a bit of texture to it, and it has a lovely shine to it because it is silk, and it's this kind of weird color. It's maybe pale gray or cream colored. It's really hard to define. It has ruffles, pleats on the skirt. It has decorated sleeves with fringe and intricate pleats on the cuffs. It's quite elaborate. And it looks like it belongs to someone who has a lot of social status.
The dresses on display at the Athenaeum actually come from a textile collection owned by the University Museum of UNH. Originally assembled as a teaching tool for the Home Economics Department in the 1920s, the records that once identified these garments were lost long ago.
So this is an example of this great garment and no information in the files other than a number.
To rediscover the origins of the pale gray dress, Schaefer first had to examine its design.
The first thing I do is I look at the way the bodice is pieced and sewn together, because in the 19th century, you can really date something by the number of pieces that go into the bodice or the top part of a dress. Does it have a center back seam? All kinds of little tells.
With these tells, Schaefer is able to date the dress's construction to the 1870s. But her biggest clue was not in the detail. It was written on the inside of the dress.
Someone had taken ballpoint pen, which is really unusual to do, and written on the skirt waistband, B. Freeman, Somersworth, New Hampshire. Now, that's not something anyone in a museum would ever do to an object. This is, however, something that maybe the owner might have done before handing it over.
And so, armed with a last name and a decade, Schaefer had all she needed to solve the case.
I started searching through inventories, probate inventories, and census records and so on, and I found there was only one Freeman family in Somersworth in the 1870s. A woman named Celestia, who is married to Cyrus, and as it happens, in the 1870s, she gave birth to a little girl named Bessie. So there we go. There's our bee and our Freeman.
The process of discovering the owner of the pale gray dress is pretty incredible. Folded into the elaborate designs are a much deeper story about status, identity, and the birth of DIY fashion, because this dress was not bought, it was handmade. And where you or I might only see an old-fashioned garment, Astrida Schaefer sees so much more.
Celestia did not really know what she was doing, basically. There are things like the buttonholes being far too small. The overskirt is just not put together very well. It's kind of, it hangs funny. Some of the pleats on it, especially the pleats on the lovely collar, are one particular kind called a knife pleat. But the very back of the neck has three box pleats, which have a very different structure. And those were supposed to be centered on the back, and she rather spectacularly missed. I mean, they're completely off center. No professional would have made a mistake like that. So things like that are tells that this was made by somebody who didn't really have the technical skills. to tackle the dress, but she did anyway.
So why would Celestia attempt such an impressive but ultimately amateurish recreation of high fashion?
Cyrus was a textile mill overseer, which is basically a mid-level management position, not one that afforded him a great deal of money. He was listed as having a worth of $500, and if Celestia had wanted to go and purchase a professionally made garment for herself, that would have been at least $350. There's no way she could have done that. So the only way that she could make herself the woman of status, the woman who mattered, that she wanted to, was to make the garment herself.
So here was a woman who created a dress as an act of transformation. It may not have been perfect, but the gray silk dress marks a unique era for DIY fashion. For many women of modest means, it was the first time that high design was within reach.
You have three things that came together at once. You have the invention of the sewing machine and its entry into the domestic sphere. You have a huge burst of fashion magazines geared toward women that are spreading information from all over the world, the fashion centers like Paris and London, to even the most remote parts of America. And then finally you have the development of commercial patterns. So all three of these work together to hand Celestia this moment where she could create her own identity.
So that is the story told by just one beautiful pale gray dress with buttonholes that are too small and off-center pleats at the back. There are many more on display at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. The exhibit is called Embellishments, Constructing Victorian Detail, and runs until November 6th. You can learn more about the exhibit and its curator, the costume historian Astrida Schaefer, at wordofmouthradio.org. And now for a different kind of museum detective. Producer Ari Erlbaum brings us this profile of the founder of a museum in Portland, Maine, who spends his days searching for clues about creatures that might not exist.
When Lauren Coleman was 11 years old, he watched a Japanese monster movie.
Half Human is the fantastic motion picture record of the search for the mountain creature of Asia, whose name has become a symbol of terror and mystery, the abominable snowman.
The next day at school, he asked his teachers about the Yeti.
And they gave me three answers. They don't exist, get back to your schoolwork, leave me alone. So that encouraged me to do my own research.
57 years later, he's still researching.
This is a mold taken from the footprint found outside the cabin door.
I've slept in a cabin in the Trinity Alps where there was Bigfoot sightings where they would take the antenna on cars and break them off. And I put out peanut butter and hoped that something would come, and it didn't come.
Lauren's research has been a constant in his life. When he was 12, he started writing letters back and forth with scientists and monster hunters. In college, he studied anthropology and zoology. He searched for grains of truth in folklore and interviewed countless witnesses.
It's always been cryptozoology as my out, my way to really get in touch with how much I love animals, how much I love mysteries, how much I think there's really unknown in this world.
Cryptozoology is the study of cryptids, animals that haven't been proven by science to exist. The most famous cryptids are Bigfoots, Yetis, and the Loch Ness Monster. Cryptozoologists take a scientific approach to this tabloid material. They seek proof that cryptids are real.
By measuring the width, the length, the depth of the print, their composite picture described the species as being 9 feet tall and weighing around 1,800 pounds.
During the Victorian times, the main way of proving that a fantastic beast, a creature, a cryptid actually existed was to go out and shoot one. That really is in disfavor nowadays because you might actually be shooting one of the last four or five. Most of the cryptids, we think, have very small breeding populations.
Lauren is now one of the world's most prominent cryptozoologists. He's gone on cryptid-finding expeditions, written books, and appeared on TV shows. 12 years ago, he opened the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine.
So you have Yeti material in here. You have the Orang Pindek from Sumatra. a skunk ape, Bigfoot, Sasquatch.
In the museum, there are hairs, fecal samples, and casts of footprints in glass display cases.
And then down at the end, you have lake monsters, sea serpents, mystery cats. You go a little swing around, and you'll see the mapaguari, which are reports from South America.
Artist impressions and fake taxidermies are stacked on shelves. They depict bizarre-looking cryptids of all types.
There you can actually see a dart gun that was used in the 50s to try to get one of the Bigfoot.
Amy and Alan Lewis are visitors to the museum from Rhode Island. They are here for their wedding anniversary.
From an archival standpoint, that's actually really impressive that they have the actual real. I work in a library, so thinking about just in general the collection of ephemera, it's actually really impressive.
They soon find themselves face to face with the Bigfoot.
I understand why it says don't touch the fingers, because I really want to. I'm going to. All right, you have to get my picture before we go.
Oh, yeah, clearly.
I really want to touch that hand.
No.
Okay.
You can.
I'm not going to touch the hand.
Okay, so you're probably wondering, Bigfoots, sea monsters, aren't those just the stuff of cheesy B-movies? Lauren says that they may exist, but he's pretty sure they're not part of an extraterrestrial government mind control scheme or anything like that.
What happens is that stories get exaggerated because that's what humans do with the unknown.
This is the claw that reaches out to kill.
He tries to keep things scientific. He won't even start investigating sightings or evidence until he does what he calls a psychosocial background check.
We're always very cautious of true believers that every piece of evidence they find is a Bigfoot, a monster. We talk to their relatives, their parents, people they work with, police departments in some town, and you can very quickly find out, oh, they've been telling tall tales for their whole life, they have a mental health problem, or they're really credible.
Lauren is also wary of people on the other end of the spectrum.
Debunkers. Debunkers come into any situation. It may be a good piece of evidence, but they'll throw it out because they don't, quote unquote, believe in the cryptid.
Lauren points out that cryptozoology has been successful in the past.
The mountain gorilla, the okapi, a giant squid, all of those used to be cryptids. All of them used to be part of cryptozoology, and then they became part of zoology. For the mountain gorilla, for instance, there were tales for over 60 years of these giant creatures, almost like King Kong-like beasts that would go around squeezing to death native women and killing explorers. Slowly, people started trying to hunt the mountain gorilla down, and then it was shot there in the volcanic valleys of Kenya.
Lauren doesn't expect the celebrity cryptids to be found anytime soon. His bets are on a hominid called the Orang Pendek,
which is a little 3.5 feet tall creature in Indonesia, and it's a creature that's been seen often enough. There's good evidence of footprints, there's hair samples, and it actually is in a contained enough area where there's other kinds of creatures that are pretty rare that have been seen and known about.
Creatures like the Orang Pendek hold the same excitement for Lauren that the Yeti did when he was 11.
I keep very young by being in this field. There's new reports coming in. There's new people to meet. There's new researchers that come through here. So it's always changing.
For Salt Radio, this is Ari Erlbaum.
I think we spotted him.
Sasquatch, please check the watch. This is Bigfoot, don't get it shook. Out in Japan, they call me Godzilla. Up in Africa, King Kong Gorilla.
Thanks so much for joining us as we took a little walk through the museum today on Word of Mouth. There is a lot more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show or can't catch it during the week, you can catch it in its entirety every day with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the program, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
Thousands have reported seeing this beast.
You just gotta see it to believe it.
The evidence has been elusive until now.
They call me Sasquatch. Please check the watch. Please check the time. I'm like turpentine, and it's turpentine. You exhausted, I know.